So somewhere in around about that time, we had a group of staff who portrayed themselves as keen to explore whether or not there were things like spirit life and ghosts. And so they approached me to see whether they could do some night shifts on the ward, but to be there not as workers, to be there on their own time voluntarily to see if they could gather any evidence of spirit life in the building. I was really clear with the people involved about if they were going to go there and they wanted to take photographs and all the rest of it, that any evidence that they might claim to put together belonged to the department. So they could go and they could sit, they could investigate, they could record, they could photograph, but it all belonged to the department. And I think it was the next morning or the morning after that two or three of them came into my office with some photographs and threw them on the table and said, there you go, explain that. And most of the photographs were nondescript anything at all, just vague shots down long dark corridors. But there were one or two photographs that had this sudden, almost a little S-shaped wisp of light in the middle of nothing, in the middle of a long corridor. And so they were very persistent about, go on, explain it. I said, I can't explain it, but thank you for the photographs. We will take care of it. Unfortunately, there were a second set of prints, and so I think it was that night or the next night, we had a staff member who then appeared on the news on TV, showing a copy of the photograph with this S-shaped light in the middle of a dark corridor, and criticising the department, criticising me and management for not dealing with this and not taking seriously enough. So that started a bit of a new wave of anxiety around it all, and it probably accelerated our decision then to get out of Ward 5 altogether. The work that was being done in the old Myrtle that became our Chiringa was just about finished, so we relocated, we moved out of Ward 5, it was shut down and to my knowledge was never occupied again. And so quickly that dissipated all of that anxiety and I thought it was over and done with. And I'm not sure, but it was certainly several months later when I had a phone call about a completely unrelated matter from somebody who worked for the New Norfolk Council. And in the conversation, the whole ghost story of Ward 5 was raised. And the comment was made, you know, we need another event like the ghost of Ward 5 to get people into the community to come and visit New Norfolk and help retail and commerce in the town. And I said at that time, you know, I wouldn't wish that kind of event on anyone, that it was so difficult to manage. And the woman on the other end of the phone said, really? And I explained some of what I've just explained here today. And she said, I never realised it was that difficult and that challenging, and I never realised that it impacted on your clients. I'm so sorry that we set it up. And I said, what? And she said, well, you know that we did set it up. It was actually designed to increase tourism for the town. And I said, I don't get it. And she said, well, remember the photograph with the flash of light in the middle of darkness? I said, yep. She said, we had a black screen that just had a slash through it and somebody standing behind it with a torch. And I made an expletive and hung up the phone. I was absolutely stunned that anybody would have done something so deliberately.
And that was a councillor or a council employee?
No, it was a person that worked at council.
Yeah.
And I honestly can't remember her name. It was somebody I'd met before because we were having a friendly conversation at the time. But, yeah. So that was the final point, really. It was all a setup. I don't know. I'm assuming that the logical part of me assumes that the gentleman who came back after hip surgery probably had a little bit of a weakness and stumbled and fell against the wall. He may have genuinely felt that there was something that pushed him that way. I don't know. I don't think that part was part of the setup. I think that was likely to be a genuine event. But as soon as he made the comment that I felt like I was pushed against the wall, then this group, who were very keen supporters of New Norfolk as a community, and it was at a time where the prosperity of New Norfolk was probably starting to go downhill, so I can understand to some extent their motivations. But to do this with no recognition of the impact on their colleagues as workers and their clients as people that they were there to support and assist, for me that was the most disappointing part. There was other things at that time, because again you might recall, and if not you can probably find it, there was, my recollection is there was a two-page spread in the Mercury from somebody claiming to be a psychic who had connected with the ghost, and that the ghost's name was Winston, and that Winston used to work in the boot shop in the original Willow Court building. And of course, public service being public service, we had to investigate every such claim. So we were then charged with going back through the history to see whether we could find anyone called Winston or somebody with Winston as a surname who may have worked in a boot shop in the historical part of the campus. And so we devoted, I don't know how many hours, to going through history to find any link, and there was absolutely no link whatsoever. So that took care of that part. But you're right, there's still people who talk about Winston the ghost.
Mm. Without doing the research to see if that person could have existed.
That's right.
In doing some of the research, you came through a number of books that were stored in the barracks?
Yeah, so probably preceded that actually. It was probably early in my time where people talked to me about the historical significance of the barracks building, and as I said earlier, some of the books that I read that explained the development of the campus from often largely involving people being kept under canvas until certain buildings were developed and the campus extended. So I was taken for a tour of the then disused barracks building, and I remember distinctly walking through an area that just had a dirt floor, no floorboards or anything there at all, and there were just a pile of books that had been chucked in a heap. Many of them were old receipt books and financial records and all those kind of things, but one of the books that I picked up was, and I can't remember the dates that were in it, but was beautifully handwritten in ink. And was labelled the punishment book. So it had a whole record that was filled in, it appears, by a chief superintendent or a chief attendant of some sort, who would be the judge, jury and executioner around any misbehaviours that were reported. And quite often there were interesting things about people who were laid back from the town, or who may have travelled down to Hobart and were laid back, or males who were seen trying to climb over walls to get into female dormitories and such things, and the punishment that they were given in terms of, you know, being restrained or restricted to the campus, or precluded from accessing cigarettes or whatever it may be at the time.
You talked about the changes that were happening, the deinstitutionalisation, and trying to balance that with staff that were needing to, you know, change the philosophy of the way they worked. Towards the end of the time that you worked there, what was the perspective of staff in deinstitutionalisation?
So again, I think there were a group of people who were embracing that new approach. We had taken the opportunity. So on the campus, there were a number of weatherboard houses that had been used to accommodate staff. And a number, in the separation of Willow Court and Royal Derwent, a number of those houses were then allocated to the Department of Community Services. And I made the decision that rather than use them to accommodate staff, we should actually use them to accommodate clients. So we closed initially Franklin House and relocated a number of those clients into those houses. It meant a slight redistribution in staffing. We needed more staff to accommodate them in half a dozen group homes on campus than what we needed in one large dormitory setting, particularly at night time. So we managed to squeeze that out as we were going through that downsizing process. And I think in some ways that helped to convince some of the people who were a bit ambivalent about whether deinstitutionalisation was going to work or not, that there were improvements that could be created simply through a change in environment. Not only improvements in terms of the clients, but improvements in terms of staff expectations that you could have. You had to certainly be aware of risks that are in an average three-bedroom house that are not in a dormitory with locked doors between kitchens and toilets and living areas. But it also meant that there were opportunities for people to get in and out, to do something in the backyards, and a number of them started vegetable gardens and other bits and pieces that were just much more consistent with an average lifestyle of somebody living in a three-bedroom house. So by and large, we increased the number of people who understood and were committed to deinstitutionalisation. It would be naive to think that there weren't those people who had self-interest around, am I going to be able to retain employment? if we were, as we did, we relocated people from the institution all around the state. If we were just decamping into the New Norfolk area, people would have been less concerned about loss of jobs and the impact on them personally. But to see jobs moving to the north and northwest of the state was a challenge for some of them. And there were still a small handful of people that right up to the end of my career at Willow Court, who still had their head in the sand believing that this wasn't happening, even though in the time I was there, we had gone down from, I think we had 385 clients when I started, and we were down to about 38 by the time I left. So how anyone could pretend it wasn't really happening, I wasn't too sure, but there were a couple who still felt that it wasn't happening. And from a management point of view, even that deinstitution, that downsizing of staffing was an interesting process. So because we had government commitment, there were voluntary redundancies available, and a whole bunch of people who were very happy to put their hand up for voluntary redundancy, take the money and go, particularly those who've been in the practice for a whole long time and were probably semi-retirement looking anyway. And then as a management team, we had to decide who were going to be selected for redundancies. And the initial response from my team was, let's get rid of all those people we see as troublemakers. Let's get them out first. And my decision was that that's not what we would do, because my concern was, if that's what people perceived was the way to get redundancies, then in the second year, all those that wanted redundancies were all just going to become problems, so that they could guarantee they would get redundancies. So we actually had a more considered approach and made sure that people were considered fairly and equitably through that process. And the dining area over on the Royal Derwent side for a period of time became colloquially known as the departure lounge, because there were so many ceremonies departing staff and acknowledging their contribution to the institution. And I remember one of the early ones, can't remember her name, first name, but her last name was Salter. And she had been working as a registered nurse there for many years. And in her farewell speech, she talked about how she had been born and raised in New Norfolk, and how the reputation of the town as the mad town had impacted even in her early school years. And I was shocked to hear the stories of, you know, school sports not existing because people would not go and play sports against a school from the mad town. That for me was a whole new education and perspective that I'd never encountered in my career to that point.